Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
The name of the book is The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. It is published by Knopf. Laura Riccio is the author, and we welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
At what point did you decide that this man needed to be reconsidered in some way?
Well, it was actually about 7 years ago now. I was doing some research on another book dealing with the same time period. And in Paris, I discovered slowly that in France, actually, Lafayette is not a hero, although he is very much a hero in the United States. And this got me wondering as to how it could possibly be the case that one man who really had remarkably consistent principles throughout his entire life could possibly have developed two such different reputations on two different sides of the Atlantic.
Much of this came after his return following the revolution and even being called a traitor.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's something that is very surprising to a lot of Americans to learn because, of course, here he was seen very much as an unblemished hero, and rightly so. But in France, during the French Revolution, he attempted something that proved to be, I think, impossible, which was to steer a moderate course during the French Revolution. So, in other words, at a time when royalists were digging in their heels and insisting that the absolute monarchy retain its powers, and at the same time Jacobins and other radical groups were insisting that the monarchy be abolished and that an American-style republic be implemented in France, Lafayette objected to both of these arguments. And he wanted to institute instead a constitutional monarchy of the kind that they have in England. And he was very influential. He was a very prominent figure in the period, but slowly he alienated everybody. He alienated the royalists, he alienated the republicans, until finally he had to flee for his life.
One of the things that comes very clear is here's a guy who comes to this country at 19 years old. So he's very, very young, and following the revolution, has a lot of life to live, and it is a very tumultuous life.
It is indeed, and that's really part of the reason that I wanted to write this book, because although we know Lafayette as the 19-year-old hero, he lived until he was 77 years old, and he had a very, very active public life after he left the American shores. And so I really wanted to sort of replace that image that we have that's frozen in time, that image of him at age 19 coming over here as a volunteer to serve in George Washington's army, to replace that image with one of a man who grows older and has a wide variety of other very important experiences that really impact the world stage.
What was it about him that brought him over at such a young age and put him in such a crucial position so early in his life?
It's a very interesting story, and one that I think hasn't really been fully understood here, at least, which is that he, although he was a marquis, he was actually a bit of a provincial. He came from a family in the Auvergne, in the rustic, mountainous, volcanic region of south central France, and had most things gone according to plan as they usually do, he probably would have lived out most of his life there. But as it happened, he came from a family that had developed a sort of habit. They tended to marry well and die young, so that he ended up being a very, very wealthy orphan when he was a very young boy. And because of his tremendous assets, he was married into the highest circles of the French court, even though he himself didn't have any real access to that level of society before. And he didn't have the sort of what it took to become a courtier. It was not his It's not his style. He was really someone who was dreaming of glory, military valor, ever since he was a child. And he was very dissatisfied with the life that he was living in the circles at Versailles. He said that he wanted to spare himself the inglorious life of a courtier. He wanted something that was bolder, that was more meaningful. And the American cause appeared. And because he was so wealthy, he was able to seize this moment, purchase his own ship, and sail across the ocean to pursue that dream of glory.
You do write in the book that it is certainly true that he joined the American army because he genuinely believed in the cause of liberty, but he certainly also came to this country because he wanted to reinvent himself.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that he had come to believe in the cause of liberty in part through his education in France. It's kind of interesting to think about. France was a monarchy, and yet all of their education system was based upon studying the ancient Greek and Roman republics. So he had learned about republics and he had learned about liberty and freedom all of his life. And then when the American cause came about, it was as though this opportunity to actually recreate those great republics of antiquity had suddenly appeared. And it was an opportunity that he really did not want to pass up and did not pass up.
Upon returning to France following the revolution, what impact did the public sentiment among the French have on him?
The public sentiment among the French? Well, he was very... It's interesting. When he left France, he was not very well liked, I would say, among the court at Versailles, among the high society. So when he came to America, he was a bit of an outsider. What happened was he made such a splash by coming here to America and by becoming so beloved and so famous here, winning over the love and the admiration of the American people, of George Washington, that when he returned to France, he was suddenly looked at as a completely different person. Having been sort of a rustic outsider, he was now a hero, very much associated with America.
And yet, when he became involved within the French Revolution, as we talked about, he would be branded a coward.
Yes, exactly. So what happened was, in a way, I think it was sort of an unfair comparison for him. When the French Revolution broke out, he was seen, because of the fame that he had won in America and because of his close friendship with Washington, he was hailed in France as the French George Washington. So when the Bastille fell, people in France believed that he would be the person, like Washington, who would be able to lead his nation to a new era of liberty. He was placed in charge of the National Guard. He was expected to maintain order in Paris. And as events spiraled out of control, he was unable to maintain order in Paris. And as that sort of middle ground that he was trying to occupy, that moderate middle ground, as that middle ground started to sort of erode from both sides, he essentially alienated everybody.
What was it about his character that made him such a good leader on the battlefield? How much of that do you feel was learned? How much of it do you feel was born into him?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I know that when he came to America, he actually did not have a day of battlefield experience. What he had was a great deal of youthful enthusiasm. And in fact, that enthusiasm was something that had to be tempered sometimes. And reading through the letters that Washington wrote to him and the letters that he exchanged with the French Admiral D'Estaing, you actually see that they're telling him, look, I know you really want to do this, but this just might not be the time. So he was always advocating when he was young. He was always advocating for immediate action, and he wanted to inflict as much damage on the British as he possibly could at any moment. And Washington, you know, was a bit older, a bit more circumspect, had seen a little bit more, and was telling him, you know, I think you really should bide your time a little bit. So I'd say that to his credit, Lafayette, he had the enthusiasm, the dedication, the courage that was required to become a great military leader. But when he was young, at 19, he was not yet, I think, mature enough on his own to really know how to wisely implement, to wisely put into practice some of those ideals. And so over time, by listening to Washington, Washington really took him under his wing. And by listening to Washington, being tutored by Washington, and making some mistakes, he, I think, gradually learned and grew into a much more circumspect commander than he had been in his very young youth.
I was surprised in reading the book that there are dirty parts.
Yes.
I assume this surprised you as well while doing the research.
Yes, it did. In fact, I was. It was not something I was expecting. Of course, maybe I should have expected it. This was, after all, the era of the Marquis de Sade. This was the era when Dangerous Liaisons was written. It was an era when pornography was really sort of coming into its own, as it were. And it should not have surprised me, but it did, that Lafayette came in for some pretty salacious, dirty representations. There are some pictures in the book that I don't think I can describe on public radio, but but that when I first saw them, it made me turn red just looking at them.
Of various body parts enhanced and so forth with Lafayette and Marie Antoinette. So where would these be published and how aware was he of these?
Well, it's a very interesting question. You know, some of them were so popular that they were published in different varieties and different versions at different price points, which I think also speaks to the fact that he had enemies in all classes. So I think that during my research, I came to believe that some of them were essentially commissioned by his rivals among the aristocracy. And these were very elegantly, intricately, artfully created caricatures, hand-painted and so forth. And then I would come across another version of the same image, much more roughly constructed, much more cheaply produced, that was clearly aimed at a much lower market. So these things were evidently circulating at various levels. He was very aware of them. He actually purchased all of the images that he could find depicting him. And to his credit, though, and it wasn't just images, it was that too, but also text. To his credit, he did at one point argue for the release of a bookseller who had been arrested for selling a dirty pamphlet about him. So he was very aware of them and apparently thought that it was okay in the spirit of free press for this to happen.
As you point out, President George W. Bush signed into law a measure that made Lafayette only the sixth person ever to be named an honorary American citizen. So what does that tell us about his legacy?
Well, I think it tells us that, you know, even today that we in America understand the value of international alliances, understand the value of close friendships with other countries around the world. The thing is, too, you know, when Lafayette came to America, it was really love at first sight. He immediately fell in love with the liberty, the freedom, the spirit that he found here. And I think Americans were just delighted to discover that a Frenchman, a French nobleman of all people, sort of shared some of their sensibilities, shared their deep commitment to liberty, shared their direct manner, shared their, you know, lack of pretense. And this was a friendship that really, I think, solidified French-American relations.
The name of the book is The Marquis Lafayette Reconsidered. It is published by Knopf. Laura Riccio, thank you very much for being with us and sharing your knowledge. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Again, the title of the book is The Marquis. It is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.